Blog Talk Radio.
Why are birthdays?
Well, I was going to start out with a song, but this is Anita with the Wise Women Media Radio Show, and couldn't get it queued up properly, so let's start over. One moment.
Well, I was going to start out with a song, but this is Anita with the Wise Women Media Radio Show, and couldn't get it queued up properly, so
come
start over. One moment.
Today. As we all fall down this hard scene,
everybody. Thanks for coming and listening to us on the Wise Women Media Radio Show. We want to thank you for supporting us each and every week. Please check us out on wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. And you can click on the donate link, and it'll take you right to our WePay site. We want to thank our sponsors, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, Roundtree 7, and the Hoodoo blog. This week's guest, she's a special activist, one of those independent media people, puts herself on the line to get the story out. Our special guest is Julie Dermansky. She tells stories with her beautiful photography, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Julie, and she can tell us all about what she does and why she does it. So, Julie, if you want to start at the beginning, and thank you for being with us.
Okay, sure. Well, first off, you have to forgive me for correcting you from the get-go. I'm not really an activist. People, you know, view journalists as activists when they tackle certain topics, and that's not really what an activist does. An activist, in my eyes, you know, takes a cause and works to make change. And, you know, I can see why I think it's very complimentary to see journalists who do strong work that way, but that's not really, you know, it's like someone calling me a humanist, someone working for people. I don't want to take credit for work that I'm not doing. I am a truth teller and a storyteller and an artist, but I don't really see myself as an activist.
Oh, isn't that, well, that's interesting, because I always have just taken it or just perceived it as anybody who's an independent journalist, photographer, working to get the real story out is an activist in their own right, but that's just how I perceive it. It doesn't
I couldn't argue with that. I couldn't argue with that, but it's funny. It's something that I don't call myself, because I admire activists, because I see them as people who are committed to a certain cause. But I see your point, then it would be all causes. The way I go at stories is something will pique my interest, and usually they come back to core interests of mine, and I'll dive in head first, and I'll learn everything I can on the topic. And though I don't ever fancy myself an expert on any one topic, because, you know, I mean, really, you have to commit your life to certain topics, I come to each topic with my own visual vocabulary as an artist, as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm telling a story, I'm able to look at things in a different way than someone who's, you know, just deep inside of it themselves. I'm looking at it more as a student, as someone who wants to learn what it's all about and try to portray or capture the essence of that issue or story. So I really try not to take sides at all. I just show what is. And if what is really ugly, it will seem that I'm an activist saying, you know, change this, or this is bad. But I'm really letting the viewer do that. And, you know, though when you look at my topics, you would think I have a point of view. Sure, I have a point of view, but I'm not spending my time actively involved in change.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you're dropped into a situation to look at it from just a completely different perspective. Like you're looking at it from, well, I don't like to use this analogy, but I guess it works. Like if you're dropped into the middle of it and you're looking up and just seeing everything that's going on around you. Is that kind of
sure,
what you're trying
to? Definitely. And it's with those kind of clean eyes that, you know, you can really get to the essence of a story. Because if you're so sure of how you feel about something, then you might miss something, you know. And
Right. You're looking at it in an objective way instead of an unobjective way.
Exactly.
Okay.
And stories really take their time to unfold, to get to it. I mean, that said, when Occupy Wall Street started in New York, I went up on the 10th day because I felt that this was going to be a really important story and issue of our times. And my friends in New York, some of them photographers, said to me when I got there, well, what are you doing here? It hadn't registered for them. But to me, for people to start actually occupying a space in New York, though there were precedents and it had happened before, I thought because it was so close to Wall Street that this was going to be something important. So, I don't consider myself part of the movement, but I thought the movement was important enough to get in early and stick with the story.
Yeah. What was the most interesting thing that you photographed during those early days of the Occupy Wall Street in New York?
I'd have to say I'd hope the energy, it's a funny thing to say I photographed energy, but the energy of what was happening, of the movement in its early stages of people, like-minded people, banding together and finding a voice and finding power, to actually capture that in the photos, that's what I was after. It was electric on the streets of New York in the beginning.
I could actually pick up that whole electricity vibe just by watching the videos and being myself being ex-Air Force intelligence. I look at things from different perspectives too, because that's the only way I can get the real story. I'll try to get things confirmed by three or four or five different other methods before I can figure something out. I think the most telling situation was when they were being marched across the bridge, when that group
I was in the front of the march, and I went over the top of the bridge, which was what the plan was. The Occupy movement was not planning to take the bridge. The legal advisors in the park were telling everyone very clearly to follow the law and there'd be no problem. So I'm up on the top of the bridge with the start of the march, and suddenly I see police leading. It appeared to be leading the marchers, the protesters over at the bottom. So I jumped down. And so I found myself in the middle when the police barricaded the bridge in the middle, and it was no man's land between, you know, if you were a protester or a journalist too, because that's a whole other issue, but journalists from out of state have massive trouble getting a New York City police photojournalist pass and press pass, and I couldn't get one. So I was actually told to leave or be arrested, and I couldn't leave. There was no way to leave, so I just was lucky, and someone decided to let me work and stay with the other credentialed journalists. But from my perspective, before I even read other people's account, it totally seemed like a permitted march over the bottom. I had no doubt. I have photos of the police smiling in the front of the group of people. So, you know, I'm sure you've read many accounts, but it was really radical to see what happened. It so felt like a trap to me.
Because here at home, I had pulled out several different videos taken from people, and then somebody else had actually put, I was watching the live stream, so it was after everything was going down when I was pulling videos that were very quickly being uploaded to YouTube, and what I saw from people that were up on the top that weren't on the actual street part of the bridge, I saw the police leading everybody onto the bridge, and then I saw the police on the other side with the plastic bands for the wrists tied at their waist.
Yeah, they were totally waiting. I mean, you know, apparently
they were just waiting. It was like an ambush.
And they say that, yeah, totally, and that the police said that they used a loudspeaker and told people if they went over, they were breaking the law. But it
and
makes
that was
no
a lie.
Sense. Well, let's for the sake of argument, because I haven't seen all the tapes, but let's say a police officer was there with one little megaphone. Right, so maybe five people heard this. It makes no sense. So I wouldn't say that that didn't happen, but what I would say is they own this, I'm going to say the abbreviation's wrong, but you probably know them, the NARAD system. they have this special system everyone was afraid of in Chicago where they can deafen you. They have these special boxes.
The LRAD,
The LRAD, okay. Thank you. Well, they have the LRAD. So if their argument is someone was there with a megaphone, which, again, I really wouldn't argue that. I think they actually showed in their own tape that was true. It still makes no sense. You have a crowd of thousands of people. Why would you use two people or one person with a megaphone when you have that LRAD system, you know, which can be used to make announcements, not just deafen people? So that argument was a little bit fishy to me. No question. It totally felt like a trap.
And then, of course, I watched the arrest of the child, the young girl, and, you know, that was all going on at the same time. And then, of course, you know, the guy that was live streaming, he was up on the top of the bridge, and he was shouting down.
I haven't seen it because I was down there.
Yeah, he was shouting down, you're on live stream now, and I can't even remember how many people were actually watching live stream, but it was like in the thousands. I'm thinking maybe.
It was an incredible thing. I mean, and, you know, of course, after that, no one questioned why I was in New York anymore. But
it was like 14,000 or 15,000. And what they were shouting from the top was, you know, things like, hey, we're all on the same side. They're after your pensions, too. And, you know, there was nobody screaming obscenities or anything. They were trying to, from what I could hear around the live streamer, they were really trying to reason with the police and trying to encourage them not to arrest people.
Well,
but
that was something that interesting you're pointing out, because this is something that in the beginning of the movement in New York City, where, you know, I can only speak for New York, I was in Oakland later, but in New York City, whenever someone became belligerent anti-police, someone in the crowd would silence them by changing the chant. And they kept everything civil because they didn't want the movement just to reflect some police brutality or, you know, this whole thing about, you know, such things, because that's not what it's about. Like that person was saying, you know, that these people, you know, they're part of the 99%. And a little bit of that is being lost, but, I mean, the irony just goes through to Chicago. I'm sure you've read the accounts now after the fact that those police that were out there keeping the protesters away from the site of the NATO summit and then beating some of them that did try to get a little closer, they're not being paid their overtime. So, you know, the whole issue's all carry on.
It comes back. It's like the karma rolls around, and they have to realize that their jobs are on the line, you know, as these different, cities and municipalities, you know, the funding isn't going to the people, the public money is not going to the public, you know, police.
They're part of it, unless they're on private detail, which happens an awful lot. Private detail is responsible for a lot. You know, you don't know the difference when you see someone in a police uniform. But if Wall Street's actually paying for the cops, they're being paid handsomely. And if they get overtime, of course, it does help them. But in Chicago, no one was given overtime for their seventh day or their 12th hour, and they're fighting it out now. But, I mean, that just comes back to the point, though. The movement has, unfortunately, and that's my opinion, has unfortunately started up with chants about you know, I'm on there, so I can't curse. But, you know, saying curses about the police. And I saw it first in Oakland. And, you know, I understand the anger, but I still think even to the point of the illegal arrests, it's better just to fight them and sue the system and walk away with a check rather than curse the police, because it's not the individual police. It's the people giving them the orders.
Right. It's just like in the military. It's the same thing when you're in the military. It's no person in the military is going to do something that's not, I mean, it's rare that they're going to do something on their own and not be following orders.
Right. And of course, there's always going to be the one person that flies off the handle, because the type of people that go toward law enforcement or military, some of them do have anger issues and want weapons and so forth. So, you know, but even saying that, I mean, civilians, there's always a couple that, you know, have road rage or go a little crazy. They are tense situations, but overall, the aggression is sanctioned. I mean, in New York City, they proved that it was sanctioned against journalists, and they were reprimanded by the New York Times, and Norman Siegel, the human rights lawyer, has been fighting, and there are loads of cases pending right now. And what's been happening in mass in New York is the police aren't showing up for the court cases against the people that were arrested, and the cases are being dismissed. And Norman
Siegel, how convenient.
Well, but
really
check out what people don't understand is the people that were arrested can counter sue and get up to $10,000, and people just need to know their rights. So
right.
Or what I'm saying, I'm sure there are class actions going on about the Brooklyn Bridge protests. And you know, whether this will change something or not is another issue as far as suing, you know, and of course the money comes out of the money that's desperately needed for human resources. But all the same, no one should tolerate these illegal arrests, you know.
People here are gearing up for the RNC here in Tampa, and one of the things that we know for sure is that the Tampa Police Department got $50 million.
Well, so, they got $50 million. I think they got more than Chicago then, right?
Yeah, well, what was really crazy was they got all kinds of perks. They got, you know, like handheld radios and bikes and all kinds of things. And it was by accident that I was able to hear a lot of this, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But in any case, they have these perks. They have the money. And it's like they're getting the money to commit war on the people that are going to be there protesting. It's really kind of crazy. But I happened to hear all this when I was actually sitting in Tampa City Council, and it was a wild day in Tampa City Council because one of the first things they heard on the agenda was a resolution for same-sex partnerships in the city, which was voted in. Then the backyard chicken people were there, and that was voted in. And then I was there for Move to Amend, which Tampa did adopt a local Move to Amend resolution abolishing corporate personhood. So that was voted in.
So you guys are pretty progressive there in Tampa, huh?
Well, this is recent. This is just recent, and it's pretty much because there's maybe one or two very progressive people on the Tampa City Council. But by that time, the room had cleared, and almost all the media were gone, and I was sitting there just waiting for them to do the vote on Move to Amend, and a friend was with me, and there was maybe one or two press people in the back, and that was it. And then, of course, we saw the chief of police of Tampa walk in, a female, Chief Castor. And she got right up there and talked to the Tampa City Council, and they spilled the beans on everything they were getting and how much. And I thought, wow, this is kind of not a coincidence that I'm sitting here and able to hear all this.
Yeah,
so,
and what was her motivation? Were they asking her, or I'm just curious how it even came up?
I think she had asked for she was asking for some other thing, and then they were reiterating what she had already received.
It'll be really interesting to see how it plays out there, because, you know, the strategy in Chicago was clearly to, for the most part, let the protesters do as they would if there was no damage, and just keep them away from where NATO is, and then target the people that they were the most against. That said, I mean, most of what happened seemed to be a surveillance and going after people that they, independent journalists, and making illegal arrests and harassing people that they wanted quiet down. But on the streets themselves, they literally let the protesters take the blocks that they wanted as they wanted them to avoid mass arrests in the public eye. And, you know, on the one hand, at first it seemed like a pretty smart way to handle things, because there was, for the most part, no violence and no damage. But it also says to me that this was a bunch of protesters who were nonviolent and had no intention of damaging anything. One military friend of mine said, no, it's because of the police presence that there was no damage. And I just disagree completely. If you have a bunch of anarchists going to a city who want to make anarchy, sure, if you have a huge police force, they'll get arrested, but you're not going to stop them from doing what they came to do. But that just wasn't the case in Chicago. And I don't have proof of that, but that's my personal point of view.
Down here when we had, I think, I can't remember whether it was 2003 or 2004, but we had, at that time I was working with Tampa Indie Media. So I was monitoring what was happening with, we had an event with Starhawk who was going down there. So she had come into St. Petersburg to do her event. And then I monitored what was going on down in Miami. Just, of course, back in those days, we didn't have Twitter, and we didn't, you know, there was like a news feed that we could use. It was very primitive in comparison to what we have today with Facebook and Twitter and all these social networks. So I was really watching as somebody was typing things in, and what they were doing was they were corralling people that were marching down the street into one-way streets that were dead ends. And then they were fading them in with that orange netting, you know?
Oh, they had that back then, too. I'm surprised, that kettling stuff.
And they would literally force these people into the fences at the dead-end streets at the very end and then make their mass arrests in the dead-end street area where nobody could see what was going on.
Yeah, which luckily for us all that isn't the case. If you're going to do a mass arrest, it's going to be live. I mean, there's that saying that the revolution will not be televised. Well, that has to be updated because I disagree. It will be. It will be televised. It might not be now.
It can be now. Back then when the song was written by Gil Scott-Heron, you know, we didn't have the technology we have today. So
yeah.
It's like everybody that's on the street that's got a cell phone has got a little camera or a little way to create a video, and it's out there now. And you know, I just watch YouTube. I turned off my TV some time ago, and I get all my news on the internet, and I don't feel like I miss out on anything. I miss out on being assaulted nightly by the commercials.
There you go. Or just opinion shows. It just seems to be all about opinions and, you know, celebrity when you watch the news, which is unfortunate. The only time I feel that I'm drawn to watch TV on a television, be it cable or whatever, is when there's a breaking story like what was going on in Cairo or in Haiti. And granted, you don't need it. You get it online too. But with the networks, you know, they did bring some stories you might not have found or, you know, different quality or whatever. But yeah, less and less. I don't have time to watch anymore when I'm out there anyway, so I can't say I watched a stitch of anything during the NATO protests. Apparently,
now,
it didn't
I like
get
to
very much
watch comedy if I'm going to do anything, and most
yeah.
of the times, just, you know, like when Saturday Night Live's on, for instance, I can watch it the next morning on Hulu, so I don't feel like I miss anything, but I figure if I'm going to waste an hour, I want to be laughing, I don't want to be crying, so that's
fair
kind
enough.
Of where I'm at with that. And I don't even watch movies anymore because it seems like we get propagandized through those as well. So it's got to be.
Wait, you mean
really,
all that
really...
product placement bothers you?
Well, yeah, but also it's almost like some of these movies are trying to direct the masses on how to think.
Well, that's always been the case with Hollywood movies, I think, since the beginning.
Right, right. Avatar was such a true message. I'm really surprised that it was able to be filmed. I mean, it was really exactly what was going on, you know, in Iraq, and it was just, and yet people watched that and thought it was a fairy tale, and it was that it's a sci-fi type fairy tale story, and it was beautifully done, beautiful cinematography.
But it's interesting you say
it.
That. But the reason why that something like that can get through is because when you take a really brilliant artist, they can sneak things by, and it's always been the case.
No, it's
the
just
whole
like
thing. At the end of the movie, I wanted to stand up and say, don't you people get it? This is exactly what we're doing in Iraq. Don't you understand?
Yeah,
I was like,
I haven't seen the movie, but yeah, it sure did raise a bunch of controversy.
Yeah, there was some articles written on Op-Ed News about it, and I didn't want to embarrass my boyfriend by doing that in the theater, but and he didn't even catch it. You know, it was like I'm sitting there, and it's like I'm the one catching this. Is anybody else catching it? You know, I don't know. But I thought it was a beautifully done movie. It was a beautiful fairy tale. It told the story accurately of what's going on. Perfect allegory. Just like they use the allegory in school all the time, you know, the comparison of Romeo and Juliet and then West Side Story. They used to use that when we were studying Shakespeare and then bringing it into the modern day. It would be the same story as the West Side Story movie.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now you make me want to watch it. I never did get around to watching that.
Oh, really? Well, all you got to do is go get the most beautiful adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, I think, was Franco Zeffirelli's
movie. Oh, no, not
movie.
That. The Avatar movie. I never
yeah,
did
go,
that.
Yeah, go see Avatar and then do... I like the Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, and then, I watched that. I had to do it for school. I watched that, and then I watched West Side Story right afterwards. And then we had to kind of fill in the blank on who was which character, you know, from Shakespeare. It was interesting. It was a really interesting study. But yeah, the Avatar, yeah, you have to watch it. I think you'll see it right away, and... But like I said, beautifully done, beautifully done. So tell me what your plans are. Are you going to be coming down to the RNC, or is that something that's kind of on the up and up right now?
Yeah, most likely I'll make it down there. You know, I just have to work out my strategy. But, yeah, I plan to come down for that. And I know I'll be in New York for the anniversary of Occupy. But I'm returning to work on a long-term project that I started many years ago, and it just kind of got derailed. But it's about dark tourism, and I've been documenting sites where there's been a history where there's social injustice or genocide, and it's taken me to many concentration camps in Europe and to Rwanda and Armenia and just different sites where there are memorials to genocide, as well as, like I said, sites of social injustice like Robben's Island in South Africa. And I have a bunch of countries and places still on that list that I want to finish up, and I'm working on a book on that topic. So I'll be getting back to that late in the fall.
So what places have you visited so far for this project? And was this project the one you got the grant for?
Oh, no. The project I got the NEA for has to do with natural history. As I said, you know, I have these kind of core issues or interests that suck me in. And natural history has been one, and social injustice and you know, what mankind is capable of. Those are like two things that I'm always drawn to. Natural history, it turns out, from a childhood fascination with the Natural History Museum in New York City, and then just the whole concept of collecting and learning, you know, history through objects. It's just something I've been drawn to, and that grant came from me doing an in-depth project where I went into the storeroom of a Natural History Museum in Scranton called the Everhart and photographed the specimens, and then installed them in the museum with my photos for the general public to see. And that's another issue in itself, is that there are all these collections that are often rotting away in basements that the general public doesn't even know exist. And I've done it in Binghamton, New York as well, where I bring the collection back to the public. And it's one of these things where it's just kind of not popular in public anymore, all the taxidermied animals and the idea of cabinets of curiosity. And natural history museums have gone more into the realm of multimedia installations of, you know, whatever, you go and you have these dinosaurs you can ride and light up and video projections. But personally, I'm more interested in the old style. So that's kind of a different topic. And that topic did, though, relate to me more into getting into what's been happening with our environment and with the Gulf oil spill, which is a story that I'm still deeply interested and involved with. If you look at the bigger picture of natural history, it's all totally related. So I'm working on that project as well as the dark tourism.
That's really, really interesting. And for anybody that wants to see Julie's work, if you go to wisewomenmedia.posteris.com, at the very bottom of my last post, there's two links. One is to Julie's website, and the other one is to get to this show. So you'll see that one that's above the bottom one. And that is Julie's website. It's web.mac.com/jsdart/site/home.html.
Oh, you don't even have to type all that if you just type in J?
Just click, if they just do web.mac.com.
No, you just have to do jsdart. com, and the rest will come up when you press enter.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, the link is there for anybody that wants to see. And I looked over some of this photography. It's all beautifully stunning. Even the specimen ones, which are very emotional and evoke sadness for me. I saw that poor little monkey preserved in the jar, and that really just made me so sad that we have to use animal testing and things like that for just science. It's just very, very sad. And it was touching. Some of the beautiful activist artwork, I was looking at that too. It was really the big one of Occupy, OWS protesters on the stairs of courthouse. We did that here in Tampa, too. The Zuccotti Park in the early days. This one was really interesting. The Holy Rosary Cemetery next to Dow Chemical in Tampa.
Oh, well, that's a series I did about an area that's been nicknamed Cancer Alley. And, you know, Louisiana has both stunning natural landscape and stunning industrial landscapes. I'm sure other states do too, but there's this particular stretch between New Orleans and Baton Rouge that's just packed with petrochemical factories, and that particular cemetery is just so packed with symbolism with that refinery right behind it. That's the picture you're referring to. But yeah, and all of these images are easy to find when you just click on the portfolio, and it has the names of all the different projects.
Yeah, I'm scanning through them now. The morgue one at Port-au-Prince. So tell me some of these different places that you've actually gone to on the dark tourism project. Where have you visited so far, and where do you plan on going?
Well, I've been to Rwanda, South Africa, Armenia, Poland, Germany. There are an awful a lot. Still on my list is to go to Argentina and to Chile. They both have museums of the disappeared, and I haven't been to them. So that's the next places that I plan to go. But yeah, I was also in Nanking. Some people call it Nanjing in China. I've been to Hiroshima, to Ground Zero, of course. But very large list. I've been to an awful lot of these sites. But I definitely need to get to South America next.
The movie Missing, for people that don't know, documents, actually it was a Sissy Spacek movie and Jack Lemmon was in it, but it documents those times in 1974 and thereabouts, and they were, Chile was going through their own, I guess it was, you could call it a civil war. It was a takeover. Melody Mayrin and a few other actors and actresses. It was really a brilliantly done movie that told the story of there were American expatriates living there, and Sissy Spacek was married to the writer, and he was one of the disappeared. And even though he was American, you know, they took him too with the rest. And her search for him, along with his father, who was the Jack Lemmon character. It was really, did you ever see that?
Yeah, sure. It's a brilliant movie. I saw it when I was pretty young, and it really made a huge impression on me. And I've seen it again just recently, and it doesn't seem dated at all. It's a very chilling movie.
And it really describes exactly what happens in a country as they're actually, you know, there's a power struggle. And the disappeared, of course, some were accounted for, some were never accounted for. But eventually the family, you know, Sissy Spacek, who played the wife, and Jack Lemmon received the body back, but not after a whole bunch of these things that occurred, you know, that are portrayed in the movie. But for our listeners that have never seen that movie, it's a little bit old now. I think it was done late 70s, early 80s. But it's
Yeah,
it's definitely worth watching.
So there's a museum there in Chile, and I think it's a few years old now that they have all the records that were uncovered, because, you know, like many places where there's mass murder, these despots, these rulers that behave like that, often document their actions and keep records of all these things. And, you know, these museums house the evidence. In Cambodia, that's one place where there's a museum there that has a lot of that stuff, and in Chile as well.
Now, if anybody's listening in and wants to call us and ask Julie any questions, feel free to give us a call at 213-816-0357, because I've got a lot more questions, and I'm sure if you go to wisewomenmedia.posteris.com and read Julie's profile, I mean, there's a lot of, you've accomplished a lot already, and we're sure to see a lot more to come. When you saw Picasso's work, I noticed that you, in your bio, you spoke on that. What did you think about that work? Photography, what I'm trying to explain here maybe is photography is so real. When I look at that form of art and expression, I think of real. This is like capturing what I'm seeing. Yet Picasso was so ahead of his time and surreal. So tell me how you can kind of admire that work, but then do the real, the actual genuine picture.
Well, for 20 years I was a painter and a sculptor before I became a photographer. I mean, I've been shooting, but photography was not my chosen media. But the way that I would say a painter, someone painting from their imagination versus someone you know, shooting reality, it's just a different tool. And, you know, you have different tools to voice yourself in different ways. And at this point in my development as an artist, I choose to actually be out there and respond in the current moment to what I'm witnessing rather than to paint. And neither is stronger or weaker. They're just different media. And when I was a kid, you know, staring at the Guernica when it was at MoMA, and now it's back in Spain, but to see that huge, huge painting and the anguish, whether it had been a photographer any famous war photography or whatever, it just captured the horror of war right there. And he did a brilliant job. I mean, he was very much politically involved and, you know, totally against what was going on in Spain. And, you know, I didn't know that stuff. I was, you know, in elementary school. But it captured the horror of what what war is, and that stayed with me my entire life and career as an artist.
And so that's why it's really important for you to do the dark tourism to
well,
pretty
yeah,
much...
it's a personal exploration, really. It's like to understand how is it possible. You know, can you blame a government or a leader, or is it something innately in human beings that make us misbehave, and some of us to a small level, some of us not at all, and some of us, to follow orders. I don't have the answers at all. I do remember losing my cool when I was a kid once and getting in a fight, and that lack of control, like what is it in me that had that moment, and how does that relate to the bigger picture? And of course, my understanding with politics and history has greatly evolved, but it comes down to that base thing. How is it possible for one person to kill or injure another one? And, I keep looking into it. I haven't found the answer to it, but it's pretty remarkable what man is capable of.
Yeah, true.
I'm damned if I'm not going to look away. That's pretty much what it is. I'm not interested in just looking at pretty pictures and stuff like that. And I'll go out and shoot some landscapes and flowers and nature. And you have to experience a little bit of everything. But I'm more drawn to what most people would want to look away from, because I think it's really important to see it and to show it to other people.
There was a time during the Gulf oil spill where I was getting a lot of pictures from people. They were personally emailing them to me, and it was when the dolphins were washing ashore, like en masse, and the babies especially that had been, aborted, and I was talking to somebody, and they were saying, well, you have to put them up. And I said, I can't even look at them. I would sob. I would just get another picture and just start crying. I was feeling, just from looking at the pictures of the animals, I was just feeling I can't even describe what I was feeling. But they were saying, you have to put the pictures up. People have to see. They have to know what's going on here. But that's how much emotion was evoked from those.
It's the innocent, and it's like children as well. It's people who just can't get out of the way. And granted, unfortunately, with the Gulf spill, none of us can get out of the way. We just don't realize it yet. to see the animals, it's devastating, there's not too much more. But those pictures, they make it real, and that's why they're important. And, you can say, why is it that people are more upset about a dead pelican than someone who's going to get cancer 5 years from now? Maybe it's just an easier corollary to when you see the oil on something, or when fetuses from these dolphins start washing up, a year later, that you can make that connection easier. I'm not really sure why people can relate more to the animals, but it doesn't matter what the reason is. It's what happened. So those pictures were really important to get the message across of the damage being done to the environment by the Gulf spill and the potential for the other wells to break apart and spill.
Now, I've heard this before, and you probably have too. When you know something, then you have to take responsibility for it. It's like when you know something and it's put on your plate, in other words, to know it, then you have to assume some responsibility to try to fix it. And that's, I don't know why, but probably three people that are very close to me have said that to me recently. I think
now those people are activists then.
Right.
Those people are activists, and that's why I didn't want to take credit as being an activist, because it's not like I think it's a negative word. No, I honor the people. I think that's an incredibly beautiful thing, that you're moved by some wrong or something that needs fixing, and you can't look away, and you go at it. But I don't limit myself. I tell stories that I feel need to be told. So I see it differently, that word. But yes, I agree. The Gulf spill turned a lot of people who were never even remotely political, let alone activists, are now activists. Mm-hmm. People who told me once they were lied to their face, it became personal. You know, to have someone from the Coast Guard look them in the eye and tell them something they knew was not true because they had just seen something different, that changed them. And that Gulf spill definitely created a bunch of activists, you know, people who woke up and know things that they didn't know, who though the information was out there, they weren't aware of it, but they are now. And that's one, maybe the only positive outcome of what happened.
I think the other thing that might have been on a really positive level was the fact that all of a sudden, with all of these activists and all these people that were putting groups on Facebook and calling each other and getting in forums and going to these events, which, of course, they were just, you know, going to events and being lied to, but still, these people were meeting in person or meeting online and developing really, really strong friendships and relationships. There was a lot of horizontal hostility, too, but you know, I've made some, you know, I would consider good friends, people that I'll be in touch with forever, no matter what, all based on, you know, our connections through the Gulf oil spill and what happened here in the Gulf region. So I consider that rather precious, and I'm not glad all of that happened that way. But at least, you know, I can walk through this life knowing that something positive came out of something that was so horrific.
Well, and it's funny you say that, because I get the benefit of any story that I dive into, because I'm interested in what people have to say. I get to meet wonderful people who share their experience with me. And that's one reason I really love to work the way I'm working. And, you know, people tend to, if you listen to what they have to say and reflect that and share it to a different audience, many doors open up. And, you know, for me, it's not just from my work with the Gulf spill, but also with Occupy and every other project I've done. It's remarkable how much people are willing to share. And the Internet is just phenomenal for sharing things as well.
Yeah, we have to use it as long as we have it, as long as we...
Right. Good that you say that.
You know,
right?
We're
people are
for
questioning
it
now. I'm seeing people complaining now that Facebook has these advertising things popping up and all of this. And, you know, yeah, I think I keep reminding people, you know, it seemed free, but nothing is free. So we'll have to see how corrupted it gets.
And that was the other thing, too. You mentioned about the activists, you know, being lied to and taking it on a personal level. I think the fact that everybody in the Gulf region knows now that the corporations are in control and that it's no longer necessarily our government that's in control, and we as a people are definitely not represented. So, you know, we elect these people to represent us, but, you know, the public money is not public anymore. It's going to other places, and we the people do without. But in any case, the corporations own the Gulf, and they've simply taken it. And I guess as a veteran, I considered that really, really bad when the Coast Guard was providing security for the oil companies, I thought.
Well, yeah, it's pretty much,
that happened.
You know, they're all
you know,
in bed with each other. Yeah, well, also, you know, just with Occupy, you don't know if a police officer is acting as a police officer for that city or as a private paid detail by the banks or by whoever else wants to hire them to be private detail. There were so many details where the cops were working for BP. Sheriffs, there were a million sheriffs that, you know, it wasn't like the sheriff you were used to seeing in an area. It was a sheriff bought in by BP, so it becomes really murky who's working for who.
Wow. Yeah, and what now? Tell me a little bit about this situation with BP. You had mentioned that you were the one who.
I got a reputation as the reporter who doesn't answer to BP, which was true. If I got somewhere and someone said, "Well, you can't go there," I'd say, "Well, who?" Well, first they'd usually say, "Who are you?" And instead of answering them right from the get-go, I'd say, "Well, who are you?" And often it was someone who was on BP staff, not even a private detail, and they'd say, "Well, you can't go there without a BP ID." And I'd say, you know, listen, I'm happy to listen to law authority, you know, proper authority, but, you know, I'm not going to answer to you. You mean nothing to me. And I would go and I would do the work that I wanted to do. And I did find myself detained, but I hadn't broken any laws, so I was let go. But I just found it unbelievable how many other reporters, too, would just turn around their car and go away. You know, BP suddenly did really own the coast. So the coverage that I did get, which is pretty extensive, a lot of it had to do with trusting my intuition and just getting to places before they were closed down. Because everywhere the oil washed up would suddenly be closed down. And it was a very difficult, very emotional story to cover for any number of reasons, but it's really tough to be told, you know, to have your First Amendment rights taken away from you. I mean, who wants that? It's just ugly.
Yeah, the freedom of the media, freedom of the press. It was like a systemic thing that they were doing actually at the time. I'm reiterating this because you and I know this happened, but people that may be listening to us might not know exactly what happened.
My God, they made the Coast Guard made a new proclamation that you couldn't go within. Oh God, what was it? It was like a couple football stadium feet away from one of the booms that they put up, which was so insane because what that did is made it so you couldn't take any proper pictures. I forget the number of feet, but that you can find easily online. And the thing is, even if you had a boat and you were to cross the boom, which the media wasn't doing, but if you were to do that, you wouldn't damage the boom. There were a couple of people that did some vandalism, and who knows who it was. I mean, I actually heard it was some of the people who were mad that they didn't get the contracts. But, you know, it could have even been, you know, agents from the government who wanted to say that people were messing up the boom. It was just a way to make sure you couldn't see the story is really what it was about. That was it. Because, you know, what I went ahead and did is I got my certification along with a class of the workers so that no one could tell me I couldn't be in the areas, and went out with the work crews in Plaquemines Parish. And they would ride right over the boom with their boats, and they never damaged the boom. You know, so it was just a ploy to keep people away. And it was ugly, and the government actually had to stand down on that one. The media didn't tolerate it.
Wow, that's interesting. So what do you think about the media and the propaganda that's coming out now about the beaches being clean and the seafood being safe and all of that?
I think it's really unfortunate that anybody would put information out that they couldn't verify. And I don't know how anyone could possibly verify stuff. I mean, a lot of what has happened is going to take years before you really know the answer. That said, I mean, some people might have already uncovered stuff that they're sure is going to be carcinogenic or is carcinogenic already. I haven't been reading too much of the scientific evidence that has been released. I do know as a photojournalist to get certain information, and so that it would be true of any journalist, a lot of it just hasn't been released because either BP has paid the scientists and they won't let it out, or the information is being held back because of pending lawsuits, like, for example, the environmental species that were killed, all of the turtles. You can't find out why they died. It isn't that the information isn't known, but it hasn't been released yet. So, you know, who's to say? Some people, you know, decided to blame it on the shrimpers and them not using the TED nets. But a lot of the turtles were washing up when the shrimp season wasn't even in swing. I find it upsetting that stories will get out before the answers can be. So they're opinion. They're not fact. And they're reported as fact, and that's unfortunate. But how long ago was it when smoking was safe? You know, so
right.
You have to use your best judgment, don't you? You know,
we had commercials that used to run on television. I'm a little bit older than you, and I remember these commercials that would say, "Doctors recommend cigarettes."
I hope people just don't take what's fed to them without asking questions. You know, that's what people have to get into their heads. If someone's telling you it's safe, why are they telling you it's safe? Don't just say, oh, it's safe, because, you know, like you said, a lot of things are run by corporate media. They're run by the corporations. If you say something different, if you're a whistleblower, God help you. You have a really steep slope to slide up if you have some information that's going to hurt, say, Monsanto. So people just need to not look at a headline and assume what they're reading is the whole story, or even the story at all. Ask questions. You know, that's what you have to hope people are going to do. Ask questions. Who does this benefit? That's a question to keep in mind when you see something. Who is this benefiting? Someone once told me a long time ago, if you want to know what's going on, don't go to the front page of the New York Times. Go to the business section front page.
Wow.
That'll dictate your other stories. So, you know, our New York Times aside, the Wall Street Journal, whatever. Don't look at the international stories. Look at the business stories, and then look at the stories. And that's one way to, you know. So you have to be creative when you look at things. Who's benefiting? What is this all about? You know, and that there's cause and effect for everything.
What do you think are the newest trends with independent media right now? What do you think is coming up, and what do you think is kind of passé and is passing by us and no longer going to be?
I couldn't really predict that stuff so much as the pitfalls of what I'm seeing. I'm meeting a lot of young indie journalists who aren't just iReporters. They're people now who think they want to become professionals, and, you know, kudos to them. However, they're making horrific mistakes. They're giving away their content for free, and they're not protecting it. If you're someone who wants to mark your photos on Flickr, Creative Commons, this is okay, but you have to know what it means, and you have to know the misuse of Creative Commons. A lot of Creative Commons means that anyone can use your image as long as it's not used in a way that it's used for advertising. So that means that if a site has ads on it, it can't take and use your picture. But guess what? They're going to. When you market Creative Commons, they're going to think it's fair game. And you can go after them, but most people don't even have a clue that their image has been used. So what I've been trying to tell people is to mark your images, all rights reserved, and then if you want to give your picture for free to someone, let them come and ask you, and then you make your decision. You don't just leave your work out there. It can be misused by someone that you don't agree with in any way. And on top of that, worse over, is you're making it impossible for indie journalists to make a living. Because if all of this content is free, why should anyone pay for it? And it's a problem because we all want to see the news and all that. You want to post your picture on Facebook, by all means do it, but put a watermark on it because you've signed a contract with Facebook telling them that they have the right to redistribute your work. Nobody is reading what they're signing, what they're agreeing to. Every time you take the terms for something, read it, for goodness sake, and then make it work for you. So what I'm saying is, if you want to share your pictures, put a watermark on it so that people can still learn and enjoy your picture, but they can't reuse it without a big copyright mark across it. You have to protect your intellectual property. You have to protect what the news is, because otherwise what you're going to find is all you have is iReporters and they won't come at it necessarily with the same wealth of knowledge as an indie reporter who's been doing it for years, who knows how to get to the bottom of the story a little better than someone who's wet behind the ears. And we need people who will go in depth and who will risk their lives and really learn things rather than just go and take pictures and, you know, post them without proper captions and ask the right questions and all this, and it becomes dangerous, and that is one of the pitfalls of the media. And what I keep as a note to some of these short these journalists who are indie journalists who are asking me all these questions, I say to them, you know, and I don't mean to be fresh with them, but I'm like, look up how to be a journalist on Google and or on Amazon, or go to your bookstore, your local bookstore, and buy a book. There are how-to books on everything, and there are some great ones on how to be a photographer, how to get your work out there. Photo Shelter has some great seminars. This stuff is all learnable. You don't have to go to school. There are lessons. There are free lessons. You can get to the basics of it, but you don't just take your work and put it out there and hope for the best. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the Occupy movement are doing that, and then they're upset. And I've seen postings when, say, a right-wing site takes their picture and takes what they're saying out of context, and they're like, well, how did this happen? And I've been explaining it to the people over and over and over, and I start to feel like a broken record. But the clearest thing I can tell to anyone who does want to turn pro is once the free guy, always the free guy. You know, and that said, of course, if you support a cause, go for it. Give that cause your pictures. But don't just make that your general policy. You know, why
right.
would you do that?
Right.
You know,
because
it
it's art like
anybody.
Everything else. You know, it's art. And I think the younger people are thinking
they're
more focused on getting the story out and getting the information out.
Well, you know
there.
What? I wish it were just that. See, that would be okay. But mm-hmm. that's not what it is. It's people who want to see their name.
Right.
Oh, but they gave me a credit. You know, a credit isn't going to pay the subway token or the gas that got you to the story. Those credits get you nothing. So if you really want to get the story out, put it on YouTube. That's fine. I don't have an issue with that. Link it on Facebook or whatever. Make sure you mark it that it's copyright though and control it. But don't post it on CNN. Please.
Yeah, because they'll just take it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, then you've made it so that they don't have to hire reporters, you know,
what
or
is
hire
the
you.
What is the process that you do to negotiate a price on, say, 50 pictures of a particular topic? How do you even go about doing that? Do you
like every other industry, there are standards. There's guidelines. I tell some photographers, you can go to Getty Images, one of the biggest corporate image licensors in the world, and you can check their calculator of what something should cost. So there are standards, you know, that to work from. So it's not like just making something up out of the blue. It's just like going to a doctor. You know, you have your top-notch people that are going to charge a little more, but, you know, then you have your regular visit, and you're going to find there's going to be a range in that area. So it's a business like everything else. It's nothing you can't learn if you want to.
Mm-hmm. So say you're doing, like, 50 photos of a topic or something. You can negotiate a price through a contract, and then the person who's commissioned you pays you whatever the contract is worth, just like with anything else. Is that how you would do it?
Well, it depends who the client is, their day rates, their hour rates. It has to do with what the usage is going to be. So, you know, there's editorial, which is primarily what I shoot, versus if you want to take that picture and then use it for your annual report or for advertising, it's a different pay scale. So, you know, it does really vary. With a lot of the media now, they set the price beforehand. So you agree or you don't agree. There isn't that much room for negotiating with fees. But, you know, if someone wants your image after the fact, that's a different story. Though there are, you know, general guidelines of what something should cost depending on the usage. So,
that's,
you know,
really
like I said, the the information is out there, and it's not that hard to get, you know. And it's like a lot of people are reinventing the wheel. When I say it's just like everything else, you can get a How to Do It for Dummies book. You know, it's really not that complicated. You can go to the public library even and get a, you know, How to Break into the Photo Business book, and that information will be there. There are programs you can buy also that will tell you how to make up prices for photography, you know, guidelines, charts. Just do a Google search and you'll come up with all kinds of information.
That's interesting. How do you feel, or how do you think about how Twitter has revolutionized the ability for people to send an instant photograph of whatever they're doing, wherever they happen to be? There's a whole bunch of different applications with Twitter, like Instagram, that goes to the iPhone.
I'm not real keen on it. I won't use it personally because of the user agreement you make with Twitter. I will not give my work to the owner of Twitter, and that's what you're doing. So until there's a way to watermark that image, I won't use that service. You know, and I'm grateful that it exists because, you know, I've checked things out from other people's work, but I would find a workaround. When I post pictures on Facebook, I put them on Flickr and then put a link to Flickr. The only pictures I'll post on Facebook direct will be a low quality cell phone shot of something of a nature that, you know, isn't worthy of news. That's more personal nature, that has no reuse value. But so again, what I'm at is it's not that I don't want to share the news with public, but I don't want to give it to the corporate entity like Histogram, or, you know, Facebook bought that Instagram stuff. Read the terms. You'll be shocked. You'll be shocked what you're agreeing to.
I'm looking at your portraits on your on your website. Amazing, amazing portraits. And I'm seeing all kinds of people here, like Brad Pitt, which, of course, you know, he's gorgeous. Cornel West, Lenny Kravitz, Mariska Hargitay, who she looks stunning in that picture. But you really kind of capture the essence of these people, and they're not portraits per se. They're kind almost candid expressions.
Yeah, those pictures, for the most part, are editorial, so I'm taking pictures of people that are doing things. I haven't, you know, made them pose or anything like that.
Uh-huh. It's really quite cool, some of these ones here, especially the children. Absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning.
Well, thank you. I try. I try really hard. But I do pose portraits as well. There's a page of family portraits, and, you know, that's one way I make my living. And I enjoy that kind of work as well. But, you know, if you can do it in the field and capture someone's essence, you definitely bring a lot with you when you go to someone's house and shoot their family.
I like the little ballerina girls with their tights. Those are cute. But, yeah, I'm looking through all of these now. So I know you probably prefer to be on the streets taking pictures of and getting the story to portraits. But are you well known in your area for doing weddings and family events?
No, the opposite with weddings, which I very much enjoy shooting. It's a huge, huge challenge. Off the customers that have come to me feel like it would be beneath me to shoot their wedding because they don't want to take me from doing an important news story. But I'm always grateful for any work anyone offers me, and I basically come at any situation with the same intensity and the same challenge. So, you know, it's a different thing when I go out personally after something, but I still bring with me the same work ethic and the same interest level. I love to photograph. So, you know, I hope it carries across in my work. I don't plan to spend, you know, the bulk of my time being a wedding photographer. That said, that's one of the reasons I'm not, you know, building up that much of my business that way. But I do really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And family of, now this would all be taking place in New Orleans. I mean, where do you actually spend your time? Is it New Orleans and New York, or where do you call home?
Last year, I definitely was more not New Orleans than in New Orleans. I call home anywhere where there's internet that I can use, but my mailing address is New Orleans now, and my driver's license became Louisiana during the Gulf spill because I didn't have time to get back north and renew. So yeah, I live here, but really I'm on the move. I can pick up and go with very little notice. I've set up my life that way where I don't have any plants to water and any pets to feed, and I can just go.
Now,
which is an art unto itself.
Do you still work on art projects, or do you just devote most of your time to photography now?
Mostly to photography. I have hidden on my website up top my fine art stuff, and I'm still open.
I'm looking at that now. Beautiful.
Public art. But yeah, just recently, I was in New Jersey, and I have a bunch of work in storage at my parents' house. And an old client had contacted me and wanted two big screens, and I still have some around, so I sent her pictures of what I had and was able to close the sale, which was a great feeling. And she wasn't too disappointed that I couldn't weld up something, you know, special for her. So, but, you know, I never did lose my love for that kind of work. It's just, it's really refreshing not to keep a studio anymore. You know, it was a lot of trouble and overhead to keep a welding shop going.
So you did tell our listeners exactly what kind of art that you did and what media that you used.
Well, I started out as a ceramic artist and then quickly moved to steel. And I did a lot of work with recycled steel before recycled was so popular. I'd dive into dumpsters and get a lot of scrap metal and make very whimsical fences and furniture and just kind of assemblage, collage, but with a welder. And I used a plasma cutter, which is a fine torch that I could use like a pencil. And I did large-scale installation work. And, you know, just like with photography, how I turn to shoot weddings or family portraits to keep going the work that I like with the steel work and the fine art, I turned to furniture making. And what ended up happening was my furniture and craft business took over my life, and I became a Sunday painter. So, you know, I'm trying to make sure the same thing doesn't happen to me with photography. But it wasn't that I lost my love for making my artwork, but the whole way system I had built up around it to sustain my workshop, but it wasn't working for me.
You know, and it was almost like you weren't meant to be in one place, it sounds
like.
Got a little restless, maybe.
That. Well, you know, people ask me about my switch, and, you know, people who know me well or know the work see some of the same qualities and subject matter and strengths in my photography versus my painting and sculpture. But what it really came down to was when I'm in a studio, I'm taking everything from inside and putting it outside, and that's what I was doing, versus as a photographer being out in the world, you're outside and you're reflecting on what you see. And it was just a switch I was ready to make. And I had been taking longer and longer trips away from my studio to document things for bookmaking and collage making and these conceptual projects. And it got to the point where that's all I wanted to do. That, combined with a childhood dream of being a photojournalist, I just went for it. So I made that impossible career switch that is possible.
Now, how does your family feel about what you do? Do they support you in it, and do they ever go with you when you travel?
Well, my mom blame me for gaining 15 pounds when I spent 5 months in Iraq, but they're very supportive otherwise. You know, my mother once said, when someone said, "Don't you worry about her," that she said she can't because it's a full-time occupation. So, no, they just enjoy my work. They're used to me. You know, they don't question too much what I do, and I try to spare them some of the
the details when I'm putting myself in situations that are a little bit tenuous.
Right, right. Now, how did you gain the weight in Iraq? Did they have good food?
Oh, I didn't know. She blamed herself. She blamed me for her weight gain because she was worried.
So I misunderstood you. Then she was eating because she was stressed about you.
Yeah. At the end of my stay, I was in Sadr City and things were heating up and there were lots of explosions. And, yes, she was paying attention to the news and, yeah, she was eating a lot. So, no. But I easily could have gained weight there. There's no question about it. The cafeterias are kept incredibly well stocked, and a lot of the soldiers found themselves on the treadmills. It was worse than college for a lot of them, having access to endless food and a lot of time on their hands.
One of the things I noticed about being in the military myself was, during basic training, the food, well, it was amazing because it was like, I was telling people, my mother's a French cook and this is not food. You know, right away I didn't like it because it was very starchy and some of the gals.
It's gotten sophisticated now. I mean, they were serving waffles on Fridays, but I wouldn't say that they were good. They'd boil them to death. But
this was before salad bars and things like that.
Oh, I can only imagine. And I was on some bases where it was just horrific, where, you know, they didn't have salad bars, where I was near the Iranian border, and all I could really stomach was Snickers bars.
They probably just had, like, hamburgers and hot dogs and junk food and stuff.
Worse. It was more like, I don't even know what it was. Actually, a public information officer greeted me and my partner, who I was working with, and said, let's go for our plate full of disappointment. It was whatever it was unedible. So, heavy on the starch, no matter where you were, no question about it. But, yeah,
well,
no,
when
it was
my
mother.
When I got out of basic training, the food, you know, when you're not living on the economy and you're living in the barracks, it's kind of like the chow hall is all you've got. And to maintain my weight, I would run a mile or two every day. But once I was in Greece, of course, and eating the food on the economy, I had moved off base and was living in an apartment. Then it was like a whole different ballgame because then I was eating really, really good food.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And it was, you know, I had to run to maintain. But if I ate at the chow hall, it was definitely starch. And it was. It was,
well, I can tell you, in Iraq, in most of the cafeterias, you have your choice of five different flavors of Baskin-Robbins ice cream three times a day. So it can be pretty dangerous over there.
Oh, my God. Oh, I couldn't do it. But that's Iraq must have been a pretty frightening place for you at first. How long did you stay there?
Well, I was there for 5 months. And yeah, it's frightening when you first get there because, you know, you don't know what to expect. But like everything else, you just kind of get used to it. And, you know, whenever you would roll off the bases, anything could happen with the improvised explosives. You know, you just took your life in your own hands when you would go to do what you were there to do. But, you know, I just, that stuff doesn't really affect me. I'm there to do what I'm there to do, to take pictures and to learn what things are. And it was a great experience for me. I learned a lot, to say the least.
Now, were there any other war fronts where you actually traveled to besides Iraq?
No, but I was in Cairo during the revolution. That was pretty intense.
Which do you think was the more dangerous place, Iraq or Egypt?
Oh, gosh, I would say neither. The most dangerous place is probably New Orleans, where I live.
Wow, okay. What was the most interesting thing that you photographed in Egypt?
Well, you know, again, it wasn't so much about interesting, so much is about the incredible energy. It's like nothing you can experience in your life to be in that kind of a crowd with that kind of a celebration when Mubarak stepped down or was thrown out. It's this kind of a electricity that to be part of and to document. I don't know if I'd use the word interesting, but just to be in the middle of it. And that's how I feel about, everywhere I go, really, is just to be there at that moment in time. It's just very special.
And do you operate knowing that, at least this is how I operate, that you're not in any given place, that there's no coincidences, that it's all planned, that you're meant to be there in the moment, at that moment? Do you feel that way sometimes, or do you feel like you sometimes get thrown into the situation?
Well, no, I'm more like how you put it. It's very proactive because I'm choosing. I'm not being sent on assignment. When I get to places, sometimes I get assignments because I let different media organizations know where I am, and I say I'm available, and then they know they don't have to pay my expenses, so I'm a good candidate to get an assignment. But I'm choosing where I go. So I think it's a proactive thing. I tell that to photographers all the time too. It's some of it's luck. And some of it's good news mojo, to be at the right spot at the right time. But you have to get yourself there. You have to leave your house, and it's a proactive thing. So it's a combination of, your own initiative and luck and karma and mojo and all of the above. But I never did think about, this is where. Well, sure, of course, I always feel like this is where I'm supposed to be because I'm kind of choosing it. So I guess I'm taking that for granted these days.
So it is good young photographers to actually come up with their own travel expenses and just make themselves available at these different, I would call them hot spots, places where they are probably going to get a job because
yes,
there's something newsworthy going
that,
on. But if they can pay for their way there,
yeah,
generally.
They need to be prepared, though, that they won't make their expenses back because the rates are so bloody low. But that is a super way to do it, to take that initiative. It definitely can put you on the map. If you look at a lot of photographers, they started that way. They got themselves to Iraq or to Afghanistan or to wherever a hot spot was. And the more remote, the more dangerous, the more difficult, definitely, definitely.
So that's a good way to get started anyway, but have your return trip ticket open-ended.
Yeah, good
right?
Good luck with that. Yeah, 1 year it did seem like my biggest fees were change ticket fees. I hate that they've gone up so much. It's all really complicated. Sometimes I'll spend hours before I press send to buy a ticket, and you have to be careful of that because then the price can go up while you're waiting. That is the hardest part. Because there is no such thing as open-ended tickets unless you want to pay a quadrillion dollars.
Well, I remember that you used to be able to buy the open-ended ticket, and if you wanted to change it around, it was like $25.
Oh, yeah,
and then after
right.
a while, they were charging $50. But then you're talking to someone here that hasn't – well, I haven't flown since 1999.
It's $100. So. It's $100 domestically plus the difference of whatever the new fare is. And it's $150 internationally. It's horrible. It's horrible.
That's
horrible.
Really crazy.
Yeah.
It just cements my decision to not ever fly again. I mean, I'm not going to fly again because, number one, I'm not going to let people put their hands on my body, and I'm not going to go through the X-ray thing. So when
well,
I travel,
so long,
I would...
anyway. Yeah, I understand you. It's funny. It's like when I talked about coming to Tampa, I talked about driving 10 hours, and that seems like nothing. It almost takes you that long anyway to go through the airport these days.
Well, practical me, that's what I always say. I always say, if I've got to spend 2 hours to queue up with my luggage, another hour for the flight, and another 2 hours to get my luggage, and then go through all those, bells and whistles and hoops and feeling up and all that crazy stuff, then I would just rather throw my shit in the car and just drive, if that's the situation.
I get it. I get it completely.
I'm in control. I'm in control. Nobody's telling me I have to do this, I have to do that,
yep.
I have to be in this
no,
line.
No, I'm with you on it. There are just some places you still have to fly, like when you want to go across the lake.
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't flown. The last time I flew was for business in 1999, and I flew out to a beautiful little town, Missouri, Joplin, Missouri. I'm sure people have heard of Joplin. And I spent probably a month off and on there. I was going back and forth. But the thing that got me being ex-Air Force was knowing when a plane needed maintenance.
Uh-oh.
And it would be a little frightening on the plane for me. I just, after a while, I just didn't handle flying very well. And then they put me on a puddle jumper. And that was it for me. I said, no more of this. I was just pretty shaken.
Well, I'm still naive about that stuff, so, you know.
Yeah, I was pretty shaken when we got to the, when we actually landed. I was so glad. I was never so happy as when I saw the ground and actually felt it under my feet. But you know what a puddle jumper is, don't you?
No, I don't.
Those little itty-bitty tiny planes that have the propellers.
Oh, yeah, I've been on those.
Yeah, no, I don't like...
You just have to hope for the best.
Yeah, well, that's it. I was hoping for the best. I was praying the whole way. Thank God it was like from some place in Missouri where we had landed, and I had to get on the puddle jumper to get to Joplin. So,
yeah, I can imagine.
You know, I didn't have to go very far. It was just within the state.
Yeah, maybe I had flown
to St. Louis and got on the puddle jumper from St. Louis. I don't know, but
you know, they always
say
it's still safer than driving. So, you know.
Oh, I'd much rather drive any day.
Yeah,
but that's the only bad part about traveling. That's really what I love the train. I absolutely adore the train, and I take it whatever chance I get. I just think that's a nice, restful, peaceful way to travel. Take a good book and a cup of, you know, some tea bags and, you know.
Yeah, it's just so limited in America, though. I guess you're on the good eastern access to that. But
we don't have the train here anymore. They took the train out of here except for cargo, and the closest place the train comes now is in Orlando. And even that is very, very limited. But you can actually get on a train in Orlando with your car and take it all the way up to Virginia.
So what are you expecting for the Republican convention? Can Tampa handle that kind of crowd?
Well, with $50 million for the police department, and then, of course, they're gearing up with all kinds of business going on, It's going to be quite the action here. And you know, Tampa is now the biggest metro area. It's surpassed Miami as far as size and I think population now.
Oh.
Miami is no longer the number one metro center in Florida. It's Tampa, St. Petersburg now.
Interesting. I didn't know. I've never been to the area, so that'll be my first time. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, it's pretty huge here. It's very spread out. We consist of probably a good 5-6 counties, depending on how some people look at it. So it's a very spread out area, and I live to the north of the city, and I live actually in a very rural area. So Tampa is just like any other city. It's international. Spanish is pretty widely spoken here. And business is really gearing up. I've been watching some of the stuff on Twitter and some of the feeds coming through for business and just how they're, you know, the hotels. And, of course,
have you been following the Occupy movement with what, you know, because I haven't seen too much, but I mean, I know some people are going down from New York for sure for it.
Well, our movement was really, really, our Occupy here in Tampa was very big in the beginning, and then it kind of dwindled off. And we still have a private camp, it's in a private park in Tampa, very close to the downtown. And it was a local business leader who's actually run for office. Actually, he made his money with the strip bars, Joe Redner.
That's great.
And he's run for office. He's an independent, really progressive. And when he knew about the Occupy people getting kicked out of what was where they were at first, which was Gaslight Park, he put the he said, "Hey, use my park. The cops can't kick you out of there because it's private property." So I thought, "Wow, that's really cool." So that's where
that's,
the encampment
is.
Yeah.
How
so,
interesting. I'll have to read.
Yeah.
Up.
So there's a lot of events coming up. You know, general assemblies are happening. People are coming in more and more to gear up for this. I'm not sure in what capacity that I would be involved or even if I am going to be involved. So that's kind of up in the air for myself. Being involved with Code Pink in the past and with the Green Party and all the other stuff that I've done, Vets for Peace is another organization. You know, I just don't know at this point, and I haven't been part of it.
I know Code Pink was pretty active in the anti-NATO stuff.
Oh, well, they'll be down here again because I had some visitors just a little, maybe a month ago. They came in for some other event, and it wasn't a protest event or anything like that. It wasn't an action, but they came in and actually scoped out the area. We met. We had some coffee, and they had actually checked out the area just for logistics to see where the free speech zones will be and all of that in the hotel. And then I kind of hooked them up with some people that can actually give them a location for some training. So they will definitely be playing an active role in whatever happens in Tampa. So.
Well, you
and
never know what's going to happen. That's going to be the high hurricane season, too. I always wonder about people who make some events at that time.
I don't understand why they did this. I don't understand
why
they
did that, too.
Tampa is so friggin' bloody hot. It's
at that time of year, huh?
And in Tampa, I hope most of them realize they're 30 miles from the beach. It's not.
Well, someone's making some money, you know. Like that's what I said in the beginning of our talk. You got to think who's benefiting. Someone is, you know. I don't have the answer to who, but that's the question you'd have to ask. Who's benefiting? You know, who does someone know that is getting most of that money in their pocket?
Yeah, and Florida gets. You know, Florida doesn't have an industry per se. Our biggest industry was the real estate, which of course is tanked out now. But the biggest industry here in Florida now is, well, it always has been tourism. $65 billion a year is what's made in Florida. So,
and it's not even in the height of tourism. Yeah, that's the low tour season in August, right? Everyone knows better to stay away.
Yeah, they're up there in Michigan and Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's what
Ohio.
I read something about that they've had to rent the convention center for like a month and a half or 2 months at top dollar rate, even though it would have been empty anyway. So that's what I mean, you know. So somebody must know somebody.
Yeah, somebody's making big bucks. And in any case, they've got the hotels and everything's pretty much
all
set.
Well, those people have asked why are the Democrats having theirs in North Carolina after, you know what's gone on there with gay rights. So if people are wondering about that Charlotte place as well, strange choice.
And you know, there's actually a movement for the people that are here to get in cars and head up there. I mean, they're literally planning that, too, like just a huge caravan going up there. So, you know, this. I'm sure these plans are all out. I mean, there's way you can't keep anything hidden anymore. It's all on the Internet. But, you know, I just worry about everybody that's going to be down there and what they're going to do and the tactics. I mean, $50 million will get you a lot of tactics. And a lot of ways to be able to carry those things out. So that's really scary.
Well, you know, luckily, though, we do have some laws, and, you know, you got to hope maybe they'll follow them. And since these protests in the past have pretty much been nonviolent and non-destructive, short of Oakland,
there really shouldn't be any issues, just more stamping on our First Amendment rights. So we'll see.
So where do we need to go next to assure that we have First Amendment rights, or do you think that they've been lost for the most part, or do you think there's still a chance to change things in regards to First Amendment media, photojournalism?
Well, I think the biggest issue people have to look at is what's happening to our whistleblowers, and that's critical. If you can't stand up from the inside and report injustice or waste, if you become a victim for that and your whole life is smashed and ruined, we have a big problem, because we owe so much to our whistleblowers, to people who've stood up and said, smoking is bad and the industry is making it more addictive and so on and so forth. And Daniel Ellsberg, who stood up against what he knew was going on in Vietnam and shared information. As he says, he would have been in jail today. Do not pass go. You know, there would have been no way for him to not be. That if you can't have that freedom, which we don't now, it's a scary time. So all I can say is that, you know, people need to hold fast and exercise their First Amendment rights when the best they can, you know, and not take them for granted. And when they see that peoples are being taken away, to stand up. You know, don't just think, oh, it's happening in the Middle East, or it's happening somewhere else, and not here, to wake up and realize the controls here and what can happen to you if you say something that isn't popular or that hurts a corporate interest.
Are you going to be covering the elections? How are you going to be involved in that?
I haven't really thought that through. That's not really my beat. I did cover. Oh goodness, now I'm forgetting his name. That's funny. You know, it really depends. I'm not that interested, to tell you the truth, of either party. I'm more interested in the events around the conventions rather than the parties and where they stand.
It's kind of like I was saying to somebody, it'd be so cool if we didn't even go there to protest, we just ignored the whole thing and just everybody converge on Tampa and we all just have events and go to concerts and hang out together. And I thought, we're all communicating on Facebook and all these other social networks. We might as well get together and just have a party.
Oh, there you go. That's kind of interesting.
I thought that
yeah.
would be so much better than standing there with signs in the heat, you know, and dumping bottles of water on ourselves. Which is inevitably going to be what happens.
Something. Yeah, you very well might be on to something. I guess people are drawn to those events because, you know, the eye of the media is there, and they don't want these people just to be able to say what they're saying, sprout all of this propaganda without the voice of reality and what's really happening. So that's the only reason I can think why people are drawn to either convention. You know, I mean, yeah, I've never personally been interested to go myself. I find that I just find both sides so distasteful, all of the propaganda, and when I think about the price tag of what's being spent to get their messages across and how the whole system works, it's all the things Occupy is fighting against. I've just always been so turned off by it. So it makes sense to me that Occupy would, you know, make their presence known in you know, the shadow of both. But I hear where you're saying, coming from too, just ignore them.
Yeah, it's kind of like just, you know, like I know I'm voting green because I'm a party member.
Think hurricane, you know, if you have a major hurricane headed your way, no one's going to be paying attention to that convention. If anything, they'll all be evacuated.
You know, wouldn't that be the shit if that happened? Oh, my God. They say with a 20-foot storm surge that Tampa, downtown Tampa, would be underwater.
Well, you know what that means? It would be. You know, these projections are pretty accurate of what potential damage lays in wait for all of us. And it seems the infrastructures, at least in New Orleans, were certainly in as bad shape as certain people had said they were. And I don't know how good the protection is in Tampa, but That's, you know, travel plans that time of year always make me nervous.
Yeah, or like these crazy people that book cruises. Where the hell do you get off booking a cruise in August and September? Because that is really the heavy-duty months for those storms, you know, for any hurricanes or anything. Tornadoes, too. Rain every day, usually, if we're not in a drought situation. But yeah, that's, I had seen like a static graphic that they have online, you know, because we have Pinellas County, which is actually on the Gulf, and then we have the big Tampa Bay, and then there's Tampa, which kind of juts out. And I had seen a static map at one point online where they had given a projection, and you could see the water. This is a 20-foot storm surge, and then it would roll over. And you could see almost all of Pinellas County is gone. So that means St. Petersburg is gone, Clearwater is gone, Dunedin all the way up to Tarpon Springs, and then most of South Tampa. So really the bay would just disappear. It would just end up being all water there. And it's really scary to think about. But if we had a hurricane of any kind of magnitude with that much storm surge, then I don't know how they'd get all the people out in time. I don't know how they'd evacuate everybody. I don't think they could because there's only three bridges that go over the bay.
Well, they might do it early. I don't know. But you have a good point there.
I've thought about that. And, we've had some close calls. We had, back in 2005, we had Charlie, which was supposed to hit within the spaghetti track, was 1 mile from our house. And, of course, it didn't make it. It hit, you know, Port Charlotte, you know, in the south. And then we had three other storms after that. And the worst damage that we had, we were living in Clearwater at the time, was because the oak trees that were in our apartment complex, what had happened after those four storms and all the rain, and none of those storms hit us directly, was the roots in these oak trees rotted. And it was a huge oak tree in front of our building where we lived, and it literally came up out of the sidewalk, and you could smell the mold. And it landed on our car, and our car
didn't.
Yeah,
these storms, you just never know what's going to happen. So it'll be an interesting time.
My car didn't even have a scratch. We were able to lift the branches and move my car out of the way. It was just a miracle. We were doing that in the middle of the storm, and everybody came by to take a picture of that tree. Because they wanted to see it, and they couldn't believe it had happened. So after that, of course, our complex had just about no trees in it because all those trees had damaged. But, it's going to be a very interesting time to see what happens, but I don't know whose brainchild that was to pick that particular timing. That was really not smart.
That's why I'm not booking any plane tickets.
That's why you need to rent a car and drive down. Then you don't have to go through the airport thing, you know. I think it's a from New Orleans, I think it's, let's see, it's 3 miles. 3 hours to Fort Walton Beach, right, from New Orleans?
I just thought that it's 9.5 hours from New Orleans to Tampa.
Yeah, that's about it, because you'd get to what is it, Santa Rosa Beach and that whole area in 3 hours, and then it's like 7 or 8 hours from there. And it's a long haul, too. I-10 is the most boring road I think I've ever been on in Florida.
Well, that's why I haven't committed to it, but it's not so much the weather, but, you know, just, you know, making it all work out, finding a place to stay and all that. Because, you know, there'll be so much media down there, that's going to be a hard one to get any kind of assignment work for. There's no question about that. People have their people in place, and these days everybody just picks up AP stories. But, you know, so usually once I have a bug for something, I follow through and get myself in place. That would be a hard one to sit out. Especially if you say the cops have spent $50 million. I want to photograph their new uniforms just like I did in Chicago.
Well, it's really crazy, but there was a rumor going around, and I don't know if it's true, but I saw a picture that was being circulated on, I think it was Facebook, that Tampa Police Department even have a tank. I'm going, what the hell would they do with a tank? My God. Are they going to shoot
that?
It was just crazy. And then somebody said, yeah, this is the new tank that the Tampa Police Department.
There were drones flying over Chicago.
Well, you know, they did a whole exercise. You can look this up. This was last week. They did an exercise in Tampa. They shut everything down. They had drones. They had choppers. And they kidnapped the mayor. This was part of the exercise. So Mayor Buckhorn of Tampa was kidnapped. And this was, I was watching the Twitter feed on it, actually. I was watching Twitter, and they were saying, well, this is happening now, and this is happening now. I'm going, oh, my God, this is all an exercise. Do they expect peaceful protesters to come into town and kidnap the mayor? I mean, why?
Well, because if they can predict it, then they can spend money to fight against it. That's all I can say.
That's exactly it. Like you said, follow the money. Who benefits from it? Exactly. So we're getting into the last 9 minutes of the show. This has kind of gone by pretty quick. Let me ask you this. What are your future plans besides the dark tourism, and where do you see yourself in about 5 or 10 years in regards to career and what you want to do and some things you envision?
Gosh, I don't really think that far ahead, to tell you the truth. I mean, after I wrap up that project, I'm still dealing with my natural history project, and it's grown and evolved as, you know, the dark tourism. What I always say is if I make a successful book, I can always do a part two, because I can't keep up with human atrocities and the museums that will have to be made in their aftermath, memorials and so forth. But with natural history, there's a museum in Tulane University that's not open to the public, where I started a project that I'm still working on. And over time, with the BP oil spill, it's tied into this bigger environmental project, you know, that and industry and all about the environment, specifically to the Gulf Coast. So I'll get back to working on that, trying to find some venues for exhibition. So, you know, it's just more of the same I'm always looking for, not only making my work, but where I can exhibit and share it and lecture and, you know, teach a little here and there and just go on, you know, being an artist. So,
have you thought about teaching photography, or have you taught photography? Or
workshops. I'm not interested in teaching anything full-time, because I want to maintain my freedom and ability to move, but I love to teach workshops. I come in and do that for different photo groups, and I've lectured at different universities, sometimes around times when I've had exhibitions. But, you know, just as long as someone invites me and I can cover my costs, I'll come and talk to, you know, classes and stuff like that. But that's always great to do.
Yeah, what I've been getting into lately is just the nature photography, like in my backyard right now. Florida nature is so beautiful, and some of the things you see here are just amazing. And I live in a beautiful rural area where there's always something that I can take a photo of, but lately, I haven't picked up the camera in probably a week or two, and I've noticed in my backyard there's these huge honeysuckle. It's honeysuckle that I actually put up and planted, and it's just grown wild. And I thought, I want to get some close-ups of these flowers now that they're all in bloom, and see if I can really do something artistic with that. So I'm going to be working on that tomorrow for a little bit. And I'll post them on Facebook, but if I do that, I'll make sure I put a watermark.
Yeah, put your watermark in there, because, you know, Facebook, actually, it just started on Friday. What their conditions say is that they can reuse your image and, you know, even, you know, re-license it. But what they are doing now is they're taking your image and making an ad as though it looks like it's from you. And people are objecting to that, but they can't. That's part of it. So they're taking your pictures to use as advertising, and they're using your name or your image, and they're linking your likes and then making it from Target.
Now, I changed some settings on my Facebook page, so maybe I don't know if
it's protected. I'm not sure. I did too, but I you'd have to read the terms still better. I think they still might be able to do it. I'm not sure. But, you know, put your watermark there. What's the harm anyway if it's a nice picture? You know, then if someone wants to use it and they don't want your watermark, they'll get in touch with you and you can decide.
Yeah. Yeah, I can call the shots on that. And, yeah. I like Flickr for the fact that you're able to, you know, do that, put whatever licensing you want on the photos. I've used Flickr myself in the past, but I always used it for political campaigns. So I have photos in Flickr from the Denis Kucinich campaign, from Cynthia McKinney's campaign.
Even then, if you have it on Creative Commons, you might want to change it to All Rights Reserved, because, again, if someone thinks McKinney is crazy or hates her, or, you know, they'll take one of your pictures out of context, and then you'll see it being used in a way you don't want to because you put it out there for free.
Right.
So again, I'm not saying that giving your work for free is bad, but you need to control. You need to keep your control of your work, and you need to decide who gets it. Don't just put it out there blanket.
And you could probably do a workshop just on that.
And actually, after my time in the NATO protests, I was thinking of doing that, at least here locally, because, you know, I'm answering the same questions for beginning photographers over and over and over again, and I'm definitely not the only one out there with this information, and like I said, it's pretty easy to get, and there are different websites you can find even, but, you know, everyone seems to have questions about copyrights when you can go to the government's copyright website and read all about how to get your copyright in, and if you want to copyright your stuff, it's a good time to do it because the rate is going to go from $30 to $70 soon.
Wow, that's rather expensive. What do you think about the poor man's copyright, where you send the items to yourself in a sealed envelope?
You look, once you take the picture in your own way, you own the copyright, but that doesn't help you in a court of law. So you'll never be able to recover what you'd be able to recover if you did it legally. So that's what the difference is. So if you steal one of my pictures and it's not copyrighted, I can still bill you, and I can even charge you 3 times the fee, and I can probably recover that. That's industry standard. You have the right fee, and because of the infringement, you can do that. However, if I sue you because I really have a copyright, I can maybe get $10,000 to $100,000, depending on how you misused it. So if you do it from the government, you can use the government to help you get a bigger settlement.
Right. Oh my goodness. There's a lot to study in this, and that's,
well, it's every business. You know, people forget that. They think photography, but even a hobby, you can take your hobby to the extreme. You know, just not, you learn up. You know, educate yourself like you would for anything else. You know, if you really like something, you know, don't just take it for granted that it's easy and everyone can do it. Just because you can take a picture doesn't mean you can make a career of it. It's like everyone can write with a pencil or type on a keyboard, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be a writer or an editor.
Right. Well, we're getting into the last couple minutes of the show, and I just wanted to tell people how they can find the archive to this show. Go to wisewomenmedia.posterous.com. That's P-O-S-T-E-R-O-U-S. Go to the bottom of the link of the post with Julie's picture and her bio, and you'll see click here to get to the show. So you can go and listen to the archive at any time, and Julie, you'll be able to use that link to pass the show around to any of your email lists. And I want to encourage people to check us out next week. We'll have another guest. We're on the air from 8 to 10 p.m., that's Eastern Time, every Monday night. Wise Women Media. Our sponsors are the Hoodooed Blog, Daughters of Isis, Roundtree 7, and Here Be Monsters. And we encourage people to go to wisewomenmedia.posterous.com and click on Donate to keep the show on the air. Julie, do you have any parting words for anybody that's listening right now?
Sure. If anyone has any questions, they can email me from my website. And if anyone in Tampa wants private lessons, they should consider letting me stay with them during the convention, and they'll get a house guest who will give lessons. So
That is a cool rate of exchange. So anybody out there that wants photography lessons, and they could probably accompany you right over there, too.
Exactly.
And learn
exactly.
That is really a nice barter exchange for anybody out there listening. But we want to say good night. Thank you, Julie, for being with us on the show, and appreciate it. And stay in touch with me, because if you come to Tampa, of course, we can hook up. So we can meet for coffee or whatever, or maybe I can help you try to get a place to stay. And see us next week on the Wise Women Media.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.